time to make sure we start on time, make sure we end on time, make sure that two of you aren't speaking at once, make sure that if you have your hand up, I call on you. Perhaps try to provoke some discussion, and I'm glad to play that role. I think forums are an important part. I would like to introduce the forum with one thing that I think is important tonight. Can we assume that there is some generally accepted understanding of the title instead of spending half the time defining community? We could easily spend the hour. What do you mean by community? Well, that's not community. If you just can't tolerate that, then there'll be a forum defining community. I mean, I won't fight you all evening, but I think if we can assume we mean by it, how can the people who are part of a congregation, who share faith in a local place, how can they support one another better? How can the friendships within there be nurtured? How can we support one another? How can we overcome that it's strangers who meet once a week at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning or some such thing? Can we assume that there is that's really what we mean? Secondly, I will give you one premise and then a kind of a byline to that. I do believe community is a gift, always. Does that discount the forum? How can we kind of make our church a community if community is always a gift? I think it is possible that there are some climates and some atmospheres where the gift is more likely to take place, or at least the other side of that. I think we can structure a church where it's almost impossible that the gift of community ever takes place. So I think it is legitimate to talk about it. I'm going to tell one story, and then I'm going to invite your stories. While we were in Washington, D.C., I had a friend who was an Episcopalian rector at a church on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Good fellow, good priest. They struggled with tonight's topic. For them, and I don't mean that what we're going to do tonight is if it works somewhere, you can package it and bring it into another church and it'll work. For them, they decided that one of the things that was going to be necessary, if that was going to be more of a community, is that the lay people were going to have to own the program more than they did. It was too dominated by the clergy. And he was the first one to say that. He was new, he thought that, and he really wanted the lay people to speak up. One of the first groups of lay people who did something was a group that was concerned with the worship life of this parish. Here's what they did. They decided that for the next 4 weeks, they would simply observe people. So at the end of 4 weeks, they made this report. When the members of this parish arrived at the door to the educational unit, which was the first thing off the parking lot, they are alive. Their faces show sparkle. They show the depth of human emotion. If the traffic was bad, they show anger. They are human beings, so sometimes they're fighting with their children. But they're very much alive. When they hit the educational unit door and enter in, there is a natural, expected, normal toning down. No problem. If you come in and you have been talking, what have you, a building tends to quiet people down. No problem. When they enter the sanctuary door, unbelievable, consistent, all life drains from their face. They just observed it for 4 weeks. They just go dead when they hit our sanctuary. This group then started making proposals, and they were implemented. Now, again, don't start saying, we couldn't do that in our parish. I'm not promoting it as an idea. First thing they did was to take the pews out. They thought that was part of the problem. Then they moved the altar. It was an old Anglican church. The altar was way. They put it in the middle. On Pentecost, they had helium-filled balloons. And when the rector told the story, he said everybody was given one. You know, those days, and I'm kind of glad some of that stuff is over. I mean, but anyway, he said everybody was given a balloon on a string. And he said, I had some parishioners if you had asked me, I would have said they were unable to smile. I really did think that the Lord had made them that they could not curl up their mouth. He said, but you can hardly shake hands with the rector with a silly balloon that you're trying to hold in one hand and not grin a little bit. Next thing they did was the events of the parish took place in that room. They moved the chairs out, and there were activities that had life to them, like parish parties and potluck dinners, so that the space did not say, you're not allowed to be alive in here. Okay. All I'm saying is, one parish started that way. I think tonight you have stories, you have dreams, you have theories, and the forum is supposed to be, what do you think it takes? What is Jim Fish's St. John's by the gas pump? He always has some church that's supposed to stand for every church out there that's a typical parish. But anyway, what does it take to make a more community?
John?
Yeah.
I see here at Holden a lot of the variety of ages interacting so well, and when we go home at my church anyway, there's tension with that. And I remember growing up in the congregation that I'm still at, and one of the things that was meaningful for me was adult recognition. If adults, when I was little, knew my name and came out of their way to say hello to me, I think that's very important that children feel that in the church, and it continues to grow as they grow.
Good start. Thank you. Anybody want to add on to that? Yeah.
My daughter graduated from high school just this June, and she's not with us because she got a job working at Lutherland, and she got from the people in that congregation, she grew up in that congregation, really, I guess 10 years now that we've been going to church there, and they sent cards to her. Some of those old bags, they hadn't smiled in their life, but they sent a card to her for, congratulations, you've made it through high school, that's really good. And a couple of them even threw in $5 bills, if you can believe it, and she was blown away. She got a lot of money from various people, relatives and friends, but she couldn't believe the stuff that came from the congregation, because she didn't think anybody had ever paid the slightest bit of attention to her. And they have been. They've been watching all along.
Do some of you, to tandem onto that, rather than jump something else, have you been in parishes, or are you in a parish now that does a good job on intergenerational, on letting the parish be intergenerational? And if so, how did it come about? Anybody feel that theirs is? Okay.
I've been involved in intergenerational programs, okay, where the family sit around in a circle, and it seemed like in this particular church it'd go as long as the session, and then right after that it'd be the divide again, where fellowship went only as far, from what I experienced, with the Christian education program. That's as far as the fellowship, no matter how it was defined, went.
Uh-huh.
That was my experience with intergenerational. It was like something that, it was just a program, and when the session was over, that's it.
All right. And I don't think, okay, go ahead. There's two hands, but you go first.
We are presently in a rural parish situation in Iowa. And I don't know if Ben and Ani's here, but coffee is one of the gathering places on, especially on Sunday mornings, but almost anything that goes on. And when it's not there, that, you know, they tend not to gather. Now, it isn't just coffee. What I'm meaning is there's some kind of refreshment as an excuse for getting people together, and it's all ages. And another thing that's happened in just the last couple of years in these parishes is the revival of a tradition that had existed, which consisted of in the old days, the youth and everybody getting together on almost every Sunday night at somebody's house and dragging a piano and refreshments and the whole bit and singing and having devotions and all that. Well, they've revived it to the point of a summer fest once a year. And part of it has been, we live in the parsonage, which is in the country,
part of it has been the necessity for the pastor and his family to accept the fact that you make your house and your land open to the people to come there. We have a yard like a park, and it would be a shame if people did not feel welcome to come there for anything they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an inconvenience. A lot of times I don't enjoy cleaning house at all, and but the idea is that that place is open to them all the time. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you have to start with, you know, what may seem like piddly little things. Revive the church supper. You know? Do something for the sake of fellowshipping people together, and you'll get all ages when you do things like that. We just celebrated 130 years of this one congregation, and the committee that decided what shall be done for that, with the pastor advising, but he was just purely there most of the time to keep order like he was doing, consisted of all ages and types of people on that committee, right down to the young, as well as the old who knew the past, and some who were new people who hadn't been around there all their life.
Yes.
The congregation I've been in for the last year, they have a talent show. It's kind of a once a year thing, and that it was really neat because it was very much intergenerational, and the people that whatever talent they wanted to share, they did. It was anywhere from, there's a little girl who do little tumbling acts and piano and musical things. And then for the folks that didn't have as much, couldn't do active things, what we did was move into the youth room after we had done the active part, and they showed their stitchery, woodwork, their crafts and talents in that way, and explained what they had done with these things. And it was neat to see even the young children really being involved with that, interested in what the older people were doing. And there's a lot of sharing that went on. That was really neat.
Let me ask two questions and see if they raise any. How many have cry rooms and really feel your church discourages infants in worship? How many have the cry room? Is that nursery during church, so that the real little ones normally are not there? How many are in churches where the disabled have been considered, so that you have ramps and accessibility and the restrooms have been made possible that the disabled can come? Anybody in church is good. That's amazing.
Not the restaurants, but they get into the sanctuary.
But they can get into the sanctuary. Okay.
Is it next year the year of the disabled?
I'm not sure. You mean in the country as kind of a theme for the year? Okay. Let me throw out another one. Kathy Kapikian, who was here on faculty, said the first thing you ought to do in your parish in order for it to start coming alive and being what most people want it to be is throw away the ecclesiastical arts catalog. Augsburg, Fortress, throw those away. Why? It stifles creativity. You never think of somebody making the altar, making the altar hangings, making the robe, a pottery chalice instead of the silver one. And how do you feel about that?
I think it's wonderful. I left the church recently this year because the children's banners were taken down by a woman who felt that they needed to get a professional artist to design all their banners. And they refused to let a student who offered to make a banner for the church make one unless it would go through a committee. And that just... I had trouble dealing with that.
We had a point at our church where, and this didn't last too long, and I was very grateful for it, where the committee decided that the flowers on the altar should be florist arranged rather than parishioner arranged. That was when I stopped cutting my beautiful rhododendrons. Mm-hmm.
Good point.
That didn't last.
It did not, it's
no,
back to...
We're now back to whatever anybody wants to do, but most people call it florist.
Yes.
I'd like to raise before this group a difficulty that we've had in our church in Los Angeles with perhaps forced ecumenism or integration, if it could be called that. There were four separate congregations which share one facility in Los Angeles. One Korean Presbyterian Church, a Finnish Lutheran Church, a Spanish Lutheran Church, which is funded by the Division for Mission in North America, and the old Swedish Lutheran Congregation, which owns the facilities and more or less subsidizes all of the other ministries too. And there are services once every 6 weeks or once every 2 months, which combine all of the congregations. And they are all combined in the Sunday school and in some of the other hospitalities of the church also. And it has moved so fast, particularly with the combined services every 6 weeks, that the sense of very strong community, ethnic and denominational community, in the Swedish Lutheran parent congregation has been severely fractured. And we may be in a period of transition to a new, larger wholeness. But there's been not only a great discouragement, but also disorientation, which has come from this. And I think which has left the laity in great confusion. The changes have been fostered by the ministers of the congregation, including the one who is brought in by the DMNA, who is a superlative person who did his internship in Chile, and I have great respect for him. But the change has been so rapid in this case that I think we've lost community, and it's particularly noticeable in the Sunday school. When our two children go to the Sunday school, they're the only Anglo kids in the Sunday school, which sounds like a prejudiced statement to begin with, but when I see my parents' congregation in Minnesota with the Sunday school of 250 kids at any one time, that is a whole society, and it's natural and healthy for children in that case at ages 3 or 7 to attend. It's the expected thing. And I wonder if there aren't some problems, particularly for the youngest children, of trying to raise their consciousness and leading them to make a commitment to Sunday school when they're in the kind of spiritual vacuum that Los Angeles so often provides. It's I really don't know where we're going in this. There's such a variety of trainings, of cultural developments, of literacy within the youth of these combined congregations that our Sunday school is in total chaos at this point.
Is there any chance of celebrating the differences?
We celebrate the differences every 6 weeks. I mean, it's. I think it's being handled about as well as it could. But that strong ethnicity, which did bind the church, has been sacrificed for a larger identity that's going to be very, very slow in coming. And the services where we have four languages, with a 3-minute sermon presented in four different languages, and the Lord's Prayer and Canon in four different languages at once, it destroys the liturgical sense that so many of the people have cherished and held very dear for themselves.
Any other reactions?
Can we come back to the the multiple age amalgamation of all ages? Every church that I've been a part of, people sort of wince and shudder when a baby cries or a child drops a hymn on it. And the feeling is it detracts from the service. I was at a couple of services at a small church pastored by a Holden graduate, Daryl Lennon, who had some sort of a, I've been unable to put my finger on it, and I'm raising it to see if someone else can put words to it. An acceptance, an air of acceptance in the worship service that embraced the little kids and the elderly who sneezed or whatever. And it was all really accepted. We even saw one time when a little baby became unmanageable and a woman came down out of the choir loft and did something to the baby. And it just seemed seems so natural in that church, and I can't put my finger on why it was natural in this church.
All right. Well, I think one way it can be natural is for the pastor to make that a part of the service. At our church, that has been the tradition, if you will, for a number of years, and it's probably at least once a month, if not two services per month, that statement is made, or it's talked about, and it's very comfortable. We who have young children are comfortable with it, and those who do not have them, I think, are comfortable with it. It's become a part of our service, and I think it leads to a warmth and a feeling of friendship that is very valuable.
Were you going to speak when I called on you, or were you?
I was just going to say that we have a new pastor in our church from one extreme to the other, where all little ones were to be in the nursery. Well, this is a nice young pastor that's Ben Holden, incidentally. He has two young children, and he is encouraging the parents to bring the young children to church. And as a result, it's an older congregation. As a result, we have more young couples that are coming in. I think maybe previously they had felt that there was no place for them in the church, and it's really great. It's going to balance things. But it's because our new pastor is setting the example, and he is concentrating on the children. He will have separate little small skits that he'll attract the children with, and they'll come up to the altar. So I don't know how the older people are reacting to it. We haven't had any feedback. It may be disturbing them a little bit, but it's bringing in young people, and I think that's good.
It's always nice when it does feel natural. One church I was in where I thought it felt natural, they had, and some, I don't mean to cut in and give a lecture when I said I wasn't going to. Sometimes it is important to spend some time thinking through and finding ways, I mean specific, making plans to try to take into consideration what you want to do. I was in a church once that had done that. They had not taken the pews out, by the way, but they did take out the first three pews. And they brought, you know, in front of pews sometimes there is then a wooden, almost a wooden wall. They kept that and had that in front of the first pew, but now they had the space that had been pews, indoor-outdoor carpet, and styrofoam fluff balls that don't make any noise, what have you. The parents with kids sat on the floor, and the first row of pews and all the rest looked over them into the sanctuary and the pulpit. They didn't bother anybody, and the kids had a good time. In other words, they just said, come up front and let the kids be more natural than having to sit still in a pew for an hour. That's why kids cry. I some others might say, ooh, I wouldn't want to do that. But there it seemed natural. They took the time architecturally to implement what they wanted to do to my parents coming. I thought
we even great. Have children's bulletin inserts for the first time in the history of the church.
Like Sambo's when they go to the restaurant.
I've had her a couple of times because we had little children.
Just a minute. Start.
We were fortunate to have a young pastor in his mid-30s who had young children. And I never saw my 4-year-old and 7-year-old so attentive in all the years that we had attended church, because every couple of Sundays or so, his sermon had something to do, or he would put his children, somehow or other an incident would have happened, and somehow or other he could tie in his own children he could go ahead and have a theme, and, you know, it would somehow or other could involve his family or his children, and the children would sit there, and he could say enough about the situation involving his children for my 7-year-old to walk away and get the same message that Sunday that I had gotten, and understanding what he meant by the entire thing. and their ears were just going like this. They're talking about Adam and Erica. We know who they are. And they'd laugh, and they could really get involved in that. And it would, you know, it would cause them to pay attention. Where now he is gone, and my daughter is bored to tears, and she wants to just go all the time. But that helped a lot.
And the intergenerational one is the one we spent the most time on. Any other comments on that one? I don't want to spend all of it on one area. But and by the way, I don't look up often enough in when I'm in here, and you're kind of in the dark, so call out. Okay.
One last comment on that. We tend to do something in the church. I think at least a lot of churches that I've been to have invite the children to remain for the service of the word, which is all spoken or sung, and really tends to be very boring. There's very little action on the part of the congregation. And we send them out to children's choir or whatever. The second half of the service, which is the liturgy of the Eucharist, which is action, which is when they could participate, when they can see things happening, is the most exciting part of the service. I think we do it backwards.
Okay.
We send them out at the wrong time.
Okay.
How many?
Yeah, here and then here. Go ahead.
I wonder if maybe part of it isn't that part of the generation thing, and also maybe some of the other things that we're trying to talk about might have to do with us thinking of our congregation as a group of families instead of a family. We don't nurture each other enough. You sit in church as a family, the baby cries, the mother and the father get red in the face and flustered, and everybody else is outside of that, and they're being bothered by it maybe, but they don't feel like they can do anything about it, help the child out. And, you know, like somebody said over here, somebody could come down out of the choir or turn around and maybe offer something that would make the whole thing a family and kind of spread that around a little bit and make it a lot better for everybody.
Okay.
I just had a question down another area about how many of the people here have churches in which they or, you know, people like themselves are involved in the regular planning of the worship activities of the church. I think of formal worship activities.
How many of you are in churches where lay people, you mean, or mm-hmm. committees or worship committees involved regularly in the planning? Up here in the fourth? Oh, the balcony is heavily in those churches more than the downstairs. Did you want to go on and make a comment on that?
No, I'm just curious about that because I think, you know, the more you have invested of your people in anything, that whether it's the formal worship activities or the potluck supper, the more lively it's going to be in terms of community.
Yes.
We just did a survey a few months ago where a futuring committee was looking at the future of the church. And they began by doing a survey of asking three questions. And the first question is, what do you see as the strengths in the congregation? And the answer overwhelmingly came back that we are family, we're community. And in a variety of ways, the congregation was seeing that as the real strength of the community, which maybe says that other parts of the program are lousy, but I guess it's the part that I would like to see as the pastor being the strong thing that they have this feeling. And then I tried to reflect on what made that. I think there are two things in our church that make for it. One is that every Sunday, except the first Sunday of the month, which is a communion Sunday, we have a coffee hour after church. And people stay around there until for almost an hour after the service before the last one's out the door. And there's a lot of sharing and a lot of fellowshipping together during that time. And I think that's important. Being in Minnesota, coffee, you know, it's
yeah.
Swedish blood transfusion. It is a blood transfusion, I think, for our people too. It loosens them up. Get some talking. A second thing which we have that was at the church before I got there is what's called a prayer chain. And the entire congregation is linked up into prayer organization. Someone is sick, someone's in the hospital, someone has lost a parent, has had a stroke, even if they don't know who they are, you know, they might live somewhere else entirely. If that person is concerned, they either ask me or call the captain of the prayer chain, and they in turn call their sub-captains who have their lists who they call. So the whole congregation in a short period of time is in prayer for that individual who's, who's having a problem or has something to rejoice about and wants to share. I think those two programs have done the most to develop this spirit and sense of community. I can't think of anything else that does it. But,
how large is the parish?
Oh, about 100 plus families.
Retired people, and we do have a lot of nice young families, and I think there's a lot of interest among the older people and nothing, their grandchildren and so on, that they pay a lot of attention to these young people that are there, but they need the leadership of a younger pastor along with the older pastor. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping we get two of them instead of one.
Let me pick up on something that he just said. Now, I just had someone recently complain that their new pastor names by name in the prayer of the church people for whom the congregation should pray, and when it's people who are ill, the pastor names the illness specifically, so that you, in other words, before the prayers there are announcements including medical terms as to what's wrong. And this person just thought that was awful on Sunday morning to be giving medical reports, and I'm sure the pastor is trying to do it so that it's more of a community. How do you feel about prayers of the, let's get some people first who haven't said it. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's kind of an invasion of privacy.
Invasion of privacy. Well, I'll just get some other comments.
Yeah, you can do that. Sure.
How do you feel about it?
I think it's good.
Very personal thing, and I think everybody in our congregation thinks it's great.
We have a lot of men who wouldn't want people talking about their prostate gland being operated on.
That's not a situation.
Everybody's waiting.
Our pastor asks when he visits, whether or not, when he visits the person in the hospital, whether or not they would like to be prayed for by name and listing the illness.
So it's a sensitive enough area that you should be careful how it's done. You had your hand up at the beginning. What were you?
Yes, I was just, the hysterectomy thing was in my mind, and I was thinking, I really don't think if I had that surgery, I would like that announced in church. Thank you very much.
I should elaborate probably a little more after comes down before the prayers and asks for, you know, who would you like to be in prayer for, and it comes from the congregation. It isn't, it isn't, I guess, like you said, looks it up before and announces it. He asks for it from the people that are there on that Sunday.
We've stayed, yes, Dory?
I know we had a couple who asked the pastor if the congregation would pray for their marriage that was almost on the rocks.
Yeah.
And I thought that was showing a great deal of faith in that congregation.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Life Institute, Bill Boswick?
I know Bill Boswick. I don't know the Life Institute. I mean, I don't know specifically what that is, but I know.
Okay, Bill started that last September in Issaquah, Washington, right by LBI.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Lee Griffin, a psychiatrist, and then they have his nephew, who is a doctor, an MD. They have those three men are the major staff in counseling people. And if there's ever a case that you do need a medical doctor, they carry, you know, bring him in too. If there's a person is not just spiritually and mentally needing counsel, if they decide that he needs, maybe the person might need the physical also, then they have that, all three, which is an indication, I think, of, you know, our body, mind, and spirit all needs to be treated. And really, the Life Institute is a wonderful treatment center for counseling of all these things. if anyone's interested, is called just the Life Institute in Issaquah, Washington. And they do, you have to sign up, and it takes a long time to get in. But I have gone, and members of my family have gone, for counseling sessions. And in 2 hour time, they dissected me, figured out all my life from before I was born until now. And then at the end of that time, they stood behind me and prayed for me. They did the same with my two teenage children. And I felt very, very relieved to be there, and very relieved that someone could be the psychiatrist, especially that he could figure it all out in such a short period of time, maybe an hour and a half period of time. And I think that the whole Voswood thing, the 2 years I've been exposed to since they came to our church with the message, to the 8 presentation series that they present, and the tape series, the whole thing is on how the Lutheran Church is learning, how we're learning about the healing of the spirit, the forgiveness and the healing of memories and all the things that are inside of us. And the physical thing, you know, where we're learning that prayer really can change things. Oftentimes, it takes us a long time to learn this, but if a person can pray for us specifically, and this is what Bill Voswood does, he specifically thinks of this organ or whatever it is about us that is wrong. And if people touch you and they pray for you, or they pray for you without even touching you, but they know what organ or what part of your body is ailing, it is felt that it is more effective, that the prayer helps to heal that part of your body through the power that the Lord has given us. When he left us, he told us that we could do even greater things than he did. And that's where Bill Voswick is working, and I think we need to remember that we're to call the deacons, we're to call the people of the church, we are a family body, to take care of each other. And you know, if it does make you embarrassed that, you know, you don't want it to be known what's wrong with you or anything, certainly you should have that right. But it's also a right of our children and of all of our members to be prayed for and for us to heal each other. And I think that's one thing I would really like to see all of us go back and really try to work on, is to locate people like the Life Institute and ask for help for healing, because it's not just us and our pride or our having to change. We talked about change earlier being really hard. The change is hard, and to have to start thinking in another direction. But I think the sooner that we open up and start saying, hey, some people are doing this in the Lutheran Church, and maybe it's not just a bunch of hocus pocus, maybe we should start praying and laying on hands on our children and our old people and all people in between, and maybe using what the Lord told us to use.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Close? Yes.
I wonder, in the churches that you have prayer change, along with that, do you have a support group that will do food and other child care and other things that are needed by families that are in trouble or somebody has to go to the hospital?
Yep.
Because that actual physical support is really absolutely fantastic.
I think in our fellowship, too, that part of the service in terms of who's in the hospital and this type of thing. We had someone who joined the church about a year ago who came from a church where that sort of thing was never mentioned. And they, you know, when we pray for someone or ask for them to be remembered in prayers, they were just so amazed that people were named by name, and that was a very significant and meaningful thing for them, I think. For some people, it's maybe a turnoff. For others, it's where it's at.
Jim?
We had twice a year where our prayer of the church was reading the roster of the congregation, which is kind of just everybody. I'll just take 15 minutes and just read it. That's the prayer. That's good. And another thing we do is, it seems strange that I would make announcements about an evangelism committee meeting when the person responsible for the evangelism committee was in the third row. I don't know why I was making an announcement about somebody else's meeting, so we stopped doing announcements during the worship service. They don't belong there anyway. But now we moved them to the end, and the fun thing was that after the service was over, whoever was doing whatever in the congregation for the coming week or month would announce their project, invite people to participate in it. Then, if someone was going to go on vacation back to Des Moines, Iowa, then they'd say that. And if someone was going to go to the hospital, or someone was going to up for tenure and they didn't think they were going to get it, or some good thing happened, all the stuff of our life got shared, and the announcements ended up being 15, 20 minutes or so. Then we went out, and sometimes the only appropriate way to end that was with prayer, and that frequently happened on Sunday morning after the service was over, and then the coffee hour would happen. And it was tears and celebration all the time at coffee, because everybody's aches and pains and joys and committee meetings were all up front, and everybody knew what was going on.
You always have that period of announcements after, not before, not as a prelude to worship. It could be either way.
It could lead into it also.
Bill Weber and Archie Hargraves and some others started the East Harlem Protestant Parish, and I don't think there have ever been more appropriate announcements, and it was for the people after the worship service, or before, I forget which. The introduction to that is, what's going on in God's world this week? So it was not only parish things, it was East Harlem and community meetings and issues. And when you announce it, what's going on in God's world this week, we're part of God's world, so it was parish things. It was also neighborhood things. We're always kind of embarrassed by the announcement. It seems to me if you maximize that, that's a point of community. It's like taking three rows of pews out. You plan so that it's not a point of awkwardness, but a point of focus. Those are good illustrations. Let me just come in with one on the general, or the prayer of the church, just being your member. There was a church in Columbus, Ohio, where 6, 8, 10 members gathered on Saturday, and they wrote the prayer of the church. In the old SBH, it was in paragraphs, remember it? Mm-hmm. They wrote those. Then on Sunday, they came to the altar, and the prayer of the church was what 8 of you, or of us, had written, with that, Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer, or something. So the prayer of the church was literally the prayer from members of the church on that Sunday. And every Saturday, different people gathered. So that over a whole period of a year, it really was the prayer of that church. And the colleagues were meant to be prayer of the church in that way, in a general prayer. It seems to me they had done some planning for it. Now I interrupted, so yeah.
Just in our parish, that's done, but one family.
One family does it.
And then they write them out and they bring them up and present them at the altar. And they go on a book, so that's done.
That's great.
If you ever are lacking one, well, you can just open the book. my reason for putting my hand up was to sort of ask a question that has been bothering me for a long time. And it's the resolution, hopefully, of a paradox. In my observation, as far as worship needs are concerned, there are two conflicting needs in most people. One is for anonymity in worship, the feeling like you're in a big railroad station and people all around, and you can feel very close to yourself, close to God, just by being very anonymous. And the other is the intimacy. And
John?
Yeah.
One example is that of Dumbarton United Methodist in Washington, D.C. It's a church in Georgetown. It's not a large congregation, but sufficiently large that one could talk about the kind of anonymity that you described, and there is a sense in which the whole body worships together and it doesn't focus on the separate individuals there. So in addition to the Sunday morning and other large gatherings at the church, the congregation has has what it calls community life groups. And because the congregation is scattered in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, the community life groups are put together in terms of geographical location. And so I think it's usually about once a month, the community life groups, on the basis of the addresses of the congregation, get together. And that's a study, and it's also worship. And that satisfies the kind of intimacy that is met by a small group. And then they know one another in the large group as well. So it goes back and forth between the large meeting of the congregation and the community life groups of people who are, in fact, neighbors to one another. But I also think that it's important to understand that no congregation is the church. And I mean, we've often said in the Community of Christ, which is a house church in Washington, that the other extreme of that is the cathedral. And there's nothing wrong with having being both a part of the house church and the cathedral. I mean, no single congregation can meet all kinds of needs that the various contexts of worship provide.
We have a large suburban church, and I don't know how many represent that kind of thing, but in our church, I think there are two families of three generations, and that's it. You know, we aren't a long history family church in a community where your great-grandparents went to this church, and about a third of the people who are there this year will be transferred someplace else next year. And so to get that feeling of community is just, for those of us who are there all the time, is an ongoing, very tiring process.
Yep.
I was reading in a book this year that when you are in like a new church in a new community, the best time to meet the people is at the coffee hours, you know, and it's after the services.
If you feel you've got them.
Right, and I think, you know, a lot of people only get to church on Sunday. We do need to put a lot more emphasis on the coffee hours after the services, or on the, you know, little prayer groups after the services. A lot of us are so geared towards, you know, getting home and getting to the roast before it burns, you know? Yeah, a lot of us are, you know, the sermon goes 10 minutes too long, you know, the roast might get burned. But I think we need to put more emphasis on the time outside of the regular service on Sunday mornings too, you know, into the coffee hours and into the...
Okay.
You know, that can even be done in worship. One of the neatest experiences in worship that I've ever had was in a small church in Eagle River, Alaska. And they tried to create an atmosphere of dialogue amongst not only pastor and people, but everyone there. And we went to church one Sunday. We were visitors. And the pastor stood up to begin worship. And he said, you know, I've noticed a lot of visitors here today, and so we're going to do something we haven't done in a while. We're going to start here in the front row, and everybody's going to stand up and introduce themselves. And it was a relatively small church, but probably over 100 people. So everybody stood up and said where they were from, and people in the congregation, we were living in Duluth, Minnesota at the time, and we said, we're from Duluth, and somebody up front said, we used to live in Duluth, and it was that kind of an atmosphere as it began. And the whole worship service was that way. When it came time to pray, the same sort of thing. The pastor would say, are there some concerns? People could say the concern, and the pastor would pray about it, or they'd pray about it themselves. The whole worship service was kind of permission to dialogue, and it was nice.
Eric?
I'd like to return for a second to the question that Luther posed earlier that has been very, I don't know, carefully avoided, or simply the kind of question that isn't out of people's own experience. What do you do with an intercultural church in terms of community? And does the community of the congregation depend upon people being like each other so that they like each other, doing similar kinds of things with a similar background, and then you can have good feelings about each other? Or is there, when you get here every 6 weeks and you have people who look different, who aren't like you, and then what do we do even if we do have our more homogenous congregation? What do you do with the people who don't fit in, who don't seem to work with various kinds of coffee hour type activities? I'm moving into an interracial church this coming year, and I'd be interested in hearing other people's experiences with that.
I think Larry's response actually spoke quite well to our situation in Los Angeles, because the church that we have belonged to is called, although it's not officially, the Lutheran Cathedral of Los Angeles, and it served that function for many years. The last two synod presidents, two of the last three from the Pacific Southwest Synod, had the pulpit of the church, and they prided themselves on overseeing the decline of the church from 1,200 members to 385 over a 15-year period, while the budget increased from 40,000 to 180,000, mainly through different kinds of social missions that we were in. But the status of that congregation, or of that place as the cathedral, continued until about 3 or 4 years ago with the liturgical service with tremendous pulpit performances by our ministers. And that finally has gone. We've lost that, and that has been given up for the sake of brotherhood, contact, integration, fluidity. And so partly this is a matter of demography, that our core congregation, Swedish Lutheran congregation, has gotten very old. And although we built residential facilities for them to live in retirement on the premises, still there are fewer people who are willing to commute 15 and 20 miles to support the church than before. And it's a loss, I think, to the worship life of the city also. And we did have, as Larry suggested, zone groups also within the cathedral, divided by sectors, and those have disappeared also.
We've got only about 3 or 4 or 5 more minutes. We have been mostly on worship, and mostly on the gathered group, if not Sunday morning, at least the gathered group. Are there any comments that come or reactions that come to our forum theme on the church being more of a community outside of that time together? Prayer chain is one of the things outside of that. Are there any other things so that we're not just, yeah?
I think one of the things that's resulting from our church having prayer chain and having an active coffee hour is a real honest concern for each other. I came from a church where the minister thought telling in the pulpit about somebody being sick was a way of nosy people knowing what was going on. He just thought that it was a matter of our being nosy, not of our being really concerned. But being in a church now where they do that, I think we've really developed a marvelous feeling of concern for each other. And when somebody isn't seen in church for a few Sundays, you call and see what's up. And if somebody's sick, or, you know, and if somebody's having problems, you get a telephone call to see, you know, how's your mom doing, even though she lives way off, or how's your sister doing, died recently. It was just really unbelievable to me that so many people in the church were concerned enough to take their time to call.
Thank you. John?
Yeah. When Dick Peterman was at St. John's in Summit, New Jersey, they used to have a daily prayer service at 8 in the morning or something, and each day there was a different family in the congregation that was the subject of prayer. And the people would be, or a series of families, however many, so each family got through within a year's time, I don't remember. And they would get a card ahead of time saying, on such and such a date, we will be remembering your family in our prayer service, and we invite you to be present and to join in the little service. This was a daily thing. It would be somewhat private in that sense because it wouldn't involve everybody, and yet everybody in the congregation, sooner or later, was involved, as well as those people with the special needs, the ill, the people with the joys, and so on. And I've been in meetings where he's told about this. I would think that would be something that would really build a feeling of community and care.
Sure.
Another thing similar to that, Carnegie Time was actually a couple years ago. In the monthly newsletter, the pastor would list the name every day on Sunday. A name would be listed of one or more members of the congregation with the little initials PF before, which meant pray for. And so during the course of the year, every member probably came up 3 times. Not only were the names listed, important events within the community or the congregation's life were listed. We organize our as the community, the founding community organization, and the day of the founding convention, that was listed to pray for college. Gave one a real sense of remembrance of the people. People were scattered over there.
We make 2 comments at the close of the forum. We try to end at 10 o'clock, and I appreciate your interest and your comments and suggestions. I think it's been a helpful one. Lyle Schaller is a good church statistician. I think if you've ever heard him, I think he's writing and doing some things that are very helpful for the whole church. I think he's United Methodist. His address used to be Naperville. By the way, the first time I heard him, I knew I liked him. The first thing he said was, "I am a statistician. Watch it. I'm the kind who can convince you if a man stands with one foot on a large block of ice and the other foot in a large pot of boiling water, on the average, he's comfortable." The last time I was with Lyle Schaller, he said, "I have now, after, I don't know what it is, 20, 25 years, there is one thing that I have uppermost. If somebody says, is there a church in this town that's going to make it of all the ones I've been with, there's one factor more than any other that I say that church is going to make it. It is not the strong pulpit. It is not the geographic location of the people, whether they're close to the church or not. It's not the repair of the building. It's not the location of the building. All of the that if I'm in a place and it's very clear that all the people feel they own the program, it's going to make it. Now, that may not be overly profound, but that's after a long period of looking at lots of factors and watching lots of rise and fall of churches. And I think maybe we've said that a couple ways. Final point, Jim Carroll, Paulist, priest, poet, has a poem that says, "The next time you see a community, pity it." I told you at the beginning that we were not going to spend a lot of time defining community because I thought we had a fairly good idea what we meant by that. The poem is that the church is a conspiracy. It's not a community. I simply want to end with that. For me, the times I have felt most part of a Christian community was when I was with a group that understood that their prime task was to be turned out in mission for the world, not in being cozy.
Well, in that case, why have you allowed the whole evening to be concerned with social tricks to encourage coziness?
That's the nature of a forum, sir. Why didn't you speak up earlier?
I tried once or twice, you didn't notice me. When you say a church that will make it will be a church where people own the program, it seems to me that that is a style of coziness which makes many fringe Christians very upset indeed. The church is supposed not to own anything. The Lord owns it. And until this last moment, you hardly said a word about the fact that Christian community often comes as a byproduct of working for the outsider, not in having extra coffee hours for the insider.
Well, that's the reason for a forum. If the last thing that was said, in essence, makes a kind of indictment over both the theme and the way we handled it, so be it. If that means that I didn't see the speaker earlier and we would have had a better forum if he spoke up earlier, so be it. I think I know Lyle Schaller well enough that I understood both his comment and that he meant to understand the mission of the church. He used a kind of in phrase, "own the program," and I think I know him well enough that that also means a theological interpretation of that. I'm quite sure that's true. The thing that I wanted to say, and I now get a chance to say it again, it seems to me that self-preservation goes on faster and dries quicker than the newest house paint, that finally the church that is community in Christ is the church that understands care for one another, certainly, but also understands its mission, so that part of the theme for Holden for the summer is that whenever we meet and whenever we understand church, that's part of it.